1400 Kemp Street building. If by any chance you go to 1400 Kemp tomorrow, I think you'll end up in a PCAM class, which I assume most of you would prefer not to be at. Some of you might want to be here, but if you end up in a chemistry class, remember in the lecture room on the opposite side of the building. Also, remember for tomorrow's discussion that I gave you kind of a thought exercise at the end of last Wednesday's discussion after we had critiqued that article that I read from the Ann Arbor News, found all the things that were wrong with that study. I asked you to think in this intervening week about the kinds of experiments you might do to do a better job of trying to find out whether there's a relationship between birth control pill usage and cancer risk. And I think I said there is no single experiment. It's not like there's one right answer. It's a very complicated question how scientists go about establishing cause and effect. So I would hope to hear a variety of approaches that you might come up with in terms of trying to experimentally address that question. So we'll discuss those tomorrow and see both the strengths and weaknesses of the various experimental approaches. Today, as you know from looking at the lecture schedule, we're going to be talking about metastasis, which the process refers to the spread of tumor cells from their primary site of origin, where they originated, to another organ via body fluids. And most of the time, we're talking about the bloodstream, the circulatory system. But you should keep in mind that there are other body fluids. There's the lymphatic system. There's the cerebrospinal fluid. There's also the peritoneal fluid in the abdominal cavity. Anywhere there's a fluid in the body that cancer cells can get into, those cancer cells could flow through that fluid and end up somewhere else in the body. So basically, it's getting a cancer cell into a fluid somewhere, transporting it to a distant site. Usually, we're talking about the bloodstream. Now, by now, you have a pretty good idea of the importance of metastasis as a phenomenon. First of all, it's part of the inherent definition of cancer. Remember, the only defining characteristic of cancer was the ability to spread by the process of invading metastasis. That's the only thing that distinguishes it unequivocally from a benign tumor. So metastasis is part of the defining features of a cancer. Also, last time you learned that metastasis is one of the main ways that cancer uses to kill people. The main cause of death is usually not the primary tumor, but metastases spreading throughout the body and often getting into one of the vital organs, such as the brain or liver or kidney. And this is often what cancer patients will die of. So this means that if we could do anything to interfere with the process of metastasis, in essence, we could cure people of cancer, or we could at least cure people of the most debilitating and threatening, life-threatening aspect of cancer, which is the ability of these cancer cells to metastasize. So today we're going to focus on metastasis. And in essence, we'll be focusing on the question of what is it about cancer cells that, in fact, allows them to metastasize, while benign tumor cells can't do this, nor do other normal kinds of cells do this. In addressing this question, first of all, you have to realize that metastasis is not a single event. When we talk about metastasis, it's not really a single process we're talking about. It's actually a sequential series of events, all of which must take place in order for this phenomenon of metastasis to occur. And commonly, we therefore divide metastasis into a series of stages, and I'm going to use three major steps to divide this process today. The first step in the process of metastasis involves the ability of cancer cells to invade surrounding tissues and vessels. That the definition of cancer, remember, was a tumor that had the capability of invading and metastasizing. Really, the first step in the process of metastasis is invasion. So the first part of the definition of a tumor cell is, in fact, of a cancer cell is, in fact, this process that is the first step in metastasis. Why do cancer cells do this, invade surrounding tissues? Why do they tend to wander off and infiltrate, penetrate surrounding tissues while normal cells don't do that? Actually, there's several factors that appear to be involved. First of all, cancer cells don't stick together. If a group of you in this room wanted to think of yourselves as a cluster of cancer cells, if you were all holding hands and joined to each other, clearly it would be very difficult to metastasize. You couldn't very easily invade. You all have to, move as an intact unit. And if all the cells in the tumor were attached to each other, it would be virtually impossible. So the first thing that cancer cells exhibit to get over this problem is decreased adhesiveness. They don't stick together. They don't hold hands, unlike normal cells. If you were to take a clump of tumor tissue, take a biopsy, a specimen of tumor tissue, put those cells into a test tube and put them in some kind of a nutrient solution, and shake that test tube very, very vigorously, you'd find that the cancer cells would readily come apart, and you'd soon have a solution, a suspension of largely individual cancer cells. Now, you might not think that's unusual until you hear what happens with normal cells. If you took a normal chunk of tissue, a biopsy from a normal region of tissue, and put them in a test tube with a nutrient solution and tried to shake them up, they would not come apart. There are very, very strong structures that hold adjacent cells together in most tissues of the body, especially in epithelia, which, remember, are the main tissues in which cancers arise. So cancer cells don't stick to each other. They're not structurally joined to each other the way normal cells are. And since they're not stuck to each other, individual cells can easily wander off. The second thing that cancer cells exhibit that allows them to evade is increased motility. And again, picture yourself as part of a clump of cancer cells. You're all holding hands. If you let go, but you just stood there, again, you're not going to invade. You're not going to go anywhere. You've got to be able to walk. You've got to be able to move. Most cells in the body don't move. Most cells are not mobile. There's some exceptions. Some cells, as part of their normal functions, need to move. But in an adult organism, very few cells actually do this. And even cells in the blood cells, you might think of them moving, but it's really the fluid that's moving more than the cells themselves. So most cells in the body don't tend to wander off, walk away, so to speak, from their site of origin. Untrue of cancer cells. Cancer cells tend to exhibit increased motility. They have contractile proteins within them. Now, most cells have these, but in cancer cells, they're being used to actively move the cancer cell from one location to another. The final thing you've got to worry about, you've seen we've gotten rid of the links that hold cells together. We've given them the ability to move. The final thing is you're not just moving through open space. Tumors are surrounded by tissue. And if cancer cells are going to move, they have to somehow get through that tissue. And the way they do this is through the secretion of a family of enzymes called proteases. And presumably from your biology background, you know what this word protease means. It's any protein digesting enzyme. And cancer cells use these proteases because much of the supporting tissue around the tumor has protein structures and protein fibers that represent a barrier. So in essence, what these proteases do is digest a path through the surrounding tissue. And especially the tissue that we call the stroma. The stroma is the supporting tissue. Perhaps connective tissue, you may have heard that term, the supporting tissue of the body. And it consists of cell types called fibroblasts, which secrete protein fibers. And these protein fibers come together to form a structure called the extracellular matrix. A dense network of intertwined protein fibers. And finally, so we've got fibroblasts, we've got these protein fibers that form the extracellular matrix, and we also have blood vessels in the stroma. And we talked about the importance of those to some extent last time. So this supporting tissue contains a mixture of cells, of protein fibers forming this matrix, and blood vessels. And if cancer cells are going to wander off and invade and infiltrate surrounding tissues, they've got to digest the path through this stroma. As I said, they do it through the secretion of proteases. And there's actually two main proteases that they use. One is called plasminogen activator. plasminogen activator actually catalyzes a reaction. It catalyzes the conversion of a protein called plasminogen and converts it to a protein called plasmin. And plasmin is an active protease, while plasminogen represents an inactive precursor of that protease. Now remember, I told you that plasminogen activator itself is a protease. What is a protease? By definition, it's something that breaks peptide bonds. So plasminogen activator breaks one of the peptide bonds in this precursor called plasminogen, which is normally inactive. By breaking that peptide bond and cleaving off a fragment from this inactive precursor, it converts it to plasmin, which now, in turn, can also function as a protease. Now you might wonder, what is the purpose of cancer cells secreting one protease whose sole function seems to be to create a second, different protease? In essence, this is an amplification mechanism. Cancer cells don't have to secrete very much plasminogen activator, because this is, in essence, an enzyme. Remember, enzymes being catalysts required in very, very small quantities. So a small amount of plasminogen activator can convert large amounts of plasminogen to large amounts of plasmin. And plasminogen is found in very high concentration in the stroma. Okay, so most of the body tissues and supporting tissues of the body's stroma contain large amounts of plasminogen. It's normally not doing anything. It's just sitting there as an inactive precursor. But when the cancer cell secretes plasminogen activator, only takes a few molecules, they can convert millions of molecules of plasminogen into plasmin, so you get a very, very high local concentration of protease from secreting just a few molecules from the cancer cell. Another protease that's active in cancer tissue is a family of proteases called matrix metalloproteases. Or MMPs. And these matrix metalloproteases are often actually produced by the stroma itself. The cancer cells somehow stimulate the stroma to again do something rather dumb from the point of view of the host organism. Remember last week I told you that cancer cells cause the normal tissue to produce blood vessels, which is sort of dumb in terms of the host because the blood vessels supported the tumor. Now the normal host tissue is doing another thing that's pretty dumb from the point of view of the host, which is producing matrix metalloproteases on the insistence of these cancer cells. And these matrix metalloproteases, again, help to break down the extracellular matrix. It appears that both of these families of proteases, they do somewhat different things, and both of them are needed in order to get efficient invasions by cancer cells through the stroma. Now, once these enzymes have allowed the cancer cell to digest a path through the stroma, the cancer cells can migrate away from the primary site of origin until they encounter a blood vessel. Usually it's a small capillary. A large blood vessel would be hard for cancer cells to get into. But small capillaries, which have a wall that's only a single layer thick, cancer cells can actually penetrate that wall, again, with the aid of these proteolytic enzymes, helping to break down the structure of that capillary wall. The cancer cells can penetrate and now get into these small blood vessels. So the cancer cells end up doing three things that allow them to start off the process of metastasis. First of all, they don't stick together, so you don't have, you know, remember I told you you can have enormous benign tumors. Benign tumors can weigh 50 or 100 pounds. And the reason they are benign is that those two cells are all stuck to each other. No matter how big the tumor gets, you still have just one massive cell. Surgeon goes in there and removes it, no matter how big the tumor, and you're cured. The only place where that's really a problem is if that tumor happens to be growing in your brain, where clearly if the surgeon doesn't get to it quickly, you can cause significant brain damage. But in benign tumors, the cells stick together, you have no problem. Malignancies, the cells don't stick together, the cells are mobile, they wander off. Finally, they secrete these enzymes and stimulate the stroma to produce more enzymes, which ends up digesting a path through the surrounding tissues and into blood. So that's the first of the three steps of metastasis, the invasion of cancer cells into surrounding tissues and into blood vessels. Once they've gotten into blood vessels, we'll go to Roman numeral 2 now, the second major stage in the process of metastasis. Once the cancer cell gets through the walls of these small blood vessels, they're now in the circulatory system. And at this point, cancer cells are transported through the circulatory system to distant sites, so through the bloodstream. In essence, the cancer cells are now free to circulate everywhere in the body. Now, you might think intuitively that once cancer cells had entered into the circulatory system, the game was sort of over, that there would be no problem getting these cancer cells transported everywhere in the body to set up distant metastases. But actually, it turns out that the bloodstream is not a particularly hospitable place for cancer cells, and in fact, very few cancer cells actually survive the trip. How do we know that? You make lots of statements. How do we know these things? Well, clearly you can't do experiments on how cancer cells survive in the bloodstream by injecting cancer cells into the veins and arteries of humans, right? That would not only be unethical, it actually wouldn't work because of the immunological rejection problem we talked about last week. So you can't study it in humans. Again, you can't study it in test tube experiments because test tubes don't have circulatory systems. So the only way you can test this is in animals. And the way it's tested in animals, you've got to have a way, once you've injected the cancer cells into the bloodstream, to follow them, to find out where they are, to follow their fates. And the way this is done is by creating populations of radioactive cancer cells. So you could take a transplantable tumor for a mouse, for example, and grow it in a mouse for a while in the presence of radioactive isotopes, put some isotopes into the mouse's diet, or do this in culture, expose these cells to radioactive isotopes, making the cancer cells radioactive. Now it's easy to spot these cells because they're radioactive. So now you isolate some of these radioactive cells, inject them into another animal's bloodstream, and you wait to see what happens. And you can use a Geiger counter or some other mechanism for monitoring radioactivity to find out what's happening to these cancer cells. What you find is that 99.9% of those cancer cells are quickly destroyed in the bloodstream. Less than 0.1% will typically survive the trip. A few days later, most of the radioactivity has been discharged from the body, broken down, gotten rid of. So most cancer cells, this is, remember, with inbred strains of animals, these animals should be able to genetically accept these tumor cells that we're working with. Yet very few of the cancer cells survive. So it's been concluded that, in fact, only a tiny fraction of the cancer cells of a typical tumor can, in fact, survive in the bloodstream and therefore lead to the process of metastasis. Now, what determines whether or not a cancer cell, in fact, can do this? Can they survive in the bloodstream, ultimately set up a distant metastasis? Is it random? Is the one cell or so out of 1,000 that survives the trip and ends up setting up a metastasis? Is that just a lucky cell that somehow escaped all the pitfalls of traveling through the bloodstream? Or was there something special about that cell, something unusual that allowed it to survive the trip? Well, if you open your course pack to page 21, let's talk about this experiment which addresses that question, or whether there's something special about the cell in the cell. These experiments involve a melanoma cell line. Remember, this is a malignancy of pigmented cells of the skin. Melanoma called B16. It's a mouse transplantable tumor. And it rarely metastasizes. If you want to implant some of these cancer cells under the skin of a typical mouse, you wait a few weeks for it to grow into large tumors, eventually you will find a few metastases in the lung. You might find one or two or three if you wait several weeks, but not very many. But let's take some of the cancer cells out of one of those successful metastases, isolate those cancer cells, put them under the skin of another mouse, and repeat the process a second time. Wait a few weeks, look in the lung. You'll find this time there may be four or five metastases, a few more than you got the first time. again, isolate those cells, inject them into a third mouse, and repeat this over and over 10 successive times. After 10 repeats, we have a cell population which we refer to as melanoma B16. They're still the cell, same cancer cell type, but we call it the F10 generation, the 10th transplanted generation, where you've selected each time four cells that metastasize and re-injected those. The melanoma B16 F10 line metastasizes very, very frequently. You inject this into an animal, and in a few weeks, you'll find hundreds and hundreds of metastases in the lung. So it is metastasizing very, very frequently. So what can you conclude from this? Although it might not be apparent immediately to you, in fact, these experiments show you that cancer cells vary in the frequency with which they metastasize. Now, how do we know that cancer cell populations vary, that they're not all the same? Let's go back and think about this experiment again. What you're obviously doing is selecting each time for those cells that have successfully metastasized. If it was sheer luck, just a random fluke that they managed to do it, then the next time you injected those cells in, the whole population shouldn't do any better at metastasizing than the first population did, if it were sheer luck. But that's not what's happening. Each time it's getting better because you are selecting specifically for those cells that know how to metastasize. And by the end, you have a highly enriched population. You've taken a cancer cell line where initially those cells represented a very, very tiny fraction of the total population. Now those cells capable of metastasizing represent a very high percentage of the population because you have been selecting for that particular type of cell. So the cancer cells vary the frequency with which they metastasize, and in this experiment, we are selecting preferentially for those cells that do have that capability. Now, although these experiments involve what I might call a gradual change in the cancer cell population induced by an artificial selection, the experimenter is selecting for this generation after generation, there is something similar that actually occurs in normal situations in people that have cancer. And we refer to this as tumor progression. And this simply refers to the process by which the cellular composition of the tumor changes with time. Based on the notion that I've just introduced you to, that cancer cell tumors, cancer cell populations are heterogeneous populations of cells. They're not all the same. In the experiment we just saw, we selected for the ability of cells to metastasize. In cancer patients, sometimes you get that kind of selection, for example. You have a primary tumor, and maybe very few of those cells can metastasize, but some of them do. Say you have a primary melanoma in the skin somewhere, and it metastasizes to the liver, a couple of them. Well, those tumors that now grow up on the liver are cells that have the ability to metastasize. So those secondary tumors can in turn metastasize, and they'll do it at a much higher frequency because you've already selected once. So now you may get cancer cells all over the body that are quite different from the initial population in the primary tumor. You've gotten a gradual progression, change in the characteristics with time as metastasis has taken place. This phenomenon may be especially important for understanding what happens during attempts to treat cancer with some of the cancer chemotherapeutic drugs that we're going to talk about later in the semester. And what you're going to learn later in the semester, but let me just give you a preview today, is that cancer patients who are treated with chemotherapeutic drugs often go into what we call a remission. And this word remission simply refers to a temporary disappearance of the disease. Temporary disappearance. And we know it's temporary because that's what the word remission means. If by some chance the drug actually cured the person and it never came back, then we would call it a cure. when it initially happens, you don't know whether it's a cure or remission. Doctors, to be safe, will usually initially say, well, the patient has gone into remission. There's no sign of the tumor now. We don't know whether it's a cure or not. We'll have to wait, you know, 5-10 years maybe, depending on how fast the tumor was growing and spreading, to know whether it was actually a cure or just a remission. Unfortunately, for people who already have metastases and were treated with chemotherapeutic drugs, most of the time, it's actually a remission. It's rare that a single treatment of chemotherapeutic drugs will completely cure a patient's cancer. Why does the disease come back? Well, what happens is, with the drug, you've killed maybe 99.99% of the cancer cells, but the 0.001% of the cells left behind, again, it's not a random group that's left behind. The cells that are left behind that weren't killed by the drug are cells that are inherently resistant to the effects of the drug. So when that cancer cell population eventually grows back, it usually can't be successfully treated with that same initial drug. So it's often, when people have remission and then the cancer comes back, it's often much, much more difficult to treat them the second time because that population has undergone progression. The cells are more aggressive. These are now resistant to the drug because those are the ones you selected for. Remember at the end of the class last time, we were looking at Folkman's experiment with endostatin. I said the remarkable thing about that experiment was, remember, he treated the cancer cells once in the animal with endostatin. The tumor went away. He removed the treatment for a while, let the tumor come back. When the tumor came back the second time, it was just as sensitive to treatment as it was the first time. It wasn't resistant. That's very unusual. With most cancer drugs, in fact, the second time the tumor comes back, it is resistant, and it's because of this phenomenon of tumor progression. Over time, you are selecting for either the body or the drugs or the metastasis. You are selecting for a more aggressive Are there any questions on this phenomenon? It's often misunderstood. So I'll make sure it's clear. Yeah, in the back.
Does tumor progression necessarily come with an enhanced grading? You know how you grade the tumor?
It's a good question. It's not exactly the same thing. Remember, I told you that tumor grading was based solely on the way cancer cells look under the microscope, what size are nuclei, mitotic index, lots of things that you see in the microscope. Those traits don't have to change in order for you to select for a population that's resistant to a drug or can metastasize more readily. Those things tend not to show up under the microscope. So often the tumor has progressed and it's quote unquote more aggressive, and you have to look at it under the microscope and it looks pretty much the same. That's not always the case. Sometimes it will look different. It would be great if it always looked different because then you could recognize it. Unfortunately, it doesn't usually look different. We're looking at different properties here. Anything else on this? Okay, well, we've seen that the tumors are heterogeneous populations of cells. They're not uniform, but heterogeneous populations of cells, only a tiny fraction of which are capable of carrying out this process of metastasis. But you can select for those cells over time and get a population that eventually is enriched in those cells to carry out metastasis. The next question I want to address is, how are these cells different? If we are selecting for cells that are more efficient at the process of metastasizing, what makes that possible? How are they different at the fundamental molecular cellular level that they can, in fact, metastasize more readily? As I just indicated from my answer to that question, it's not the way they look. It's obviously going to be something else. Well, although we are far from being able to answer this question in detail, it appears that surface properties, properties of the surface membrane of the cancer cell, have a lot to do with whether or not it can efficiently metastasize. And let me describe for you one simple experiment which makes this point. This is on the next page of the course pack. Page 22. This experiment sort of picks up where the last one took off. Remember, the experiment on page 21 ended up with this cell line melanoma B16F10 that metastasizes frequently. So we've selected for these cells that are very, very efficient in metastasizing. Now we're trying to find out why they're so good at it. What is it about these cells? Well, if you take these cells and rupture them, put them into a big blender and, you know, or grind them or something like that to rupture the cell, break them apart into their individual components. Isolate out the membranes using centrifugation to separate the membranes from the rest of the cell. Now remember, not the rest of the cell, from the rest of the cell components. We have no cell blood at this point. We have only isolated membranes. Clearly these by themselves are not cancer. They can't grow. These are not cells. They're just membrane fragments. But under certain experimental conditions, we can kind of promote the fusion of these membrane fragments to intact cells. So let's take these membrane fragments and under these conditions fuse them to melanoma B16F1 cells. Remember the B16F1 cells were the first transplant generation from the preceding experiment. These are cells that rarely metastasize. So we're taking cells that are very inefficient at metastasizing, we're fusing into their plasma membranes, membrane fragments, pieces of membrane from cells that readily metastasize. What do you end up getting? You end up getting cells that frequently metastasize. So this clearly shows that the plasma membrane influences the ability to metastasize. If you change the membrane composition, you change the ability of the cell to metastasize. Now, why is that? What's going on here? Well, we don't know for sure, but if you read the article that I signed that you're supposed to read prior to today's lecture, you know that we think that interaction between the immune system and this plasma membrane is somehow involved. Now, for you to thoroughly understand these experiments, you need to know a few basic things about principles of immunology. I assume that most of you know these, but let me quickly review them just to make sure we're all on even footing here. If you were to attempt to graft an organ, a kidney or a heart or even a skin graft, something like that, from one person to another, the recipient's immune system, obviously this is a problem with heart transplant all the time, with kidney transplant, the person receiving the organ, their immune system recognizes that organ as being foreign, as coming from somewhere else. And the immune system wants to attack that invading tissue, in essence. In order for heart transplants and kidney transplants to work, the patients have to be treated with drugs, so-called immunosuppressive drugs, which inhibit the immune system, suppress the immune system, so their immune system will not, in fact, reject those tissues as being foreign. The way the immune system normally attacks foreign tissues is using a special cell type called the T lymphocyte. The T lymphocyte is the main component of the immune system which attacks foreign tissues, foreign cells, when they're introduced into the body. And when they attack a foreign cell, what signals them that they should be doing this is a composition of that foreign cell's plasma membrane. It's something about the plasma membrane that the T lymphocytes recognize as being foreign. And part of what it recognizes, not completely, part of what it recognizes is a plasma membrane glycoprotein I assume you know what this term glycoprotein means. It's just a protein that has some sugar groups attached to it. The T lymphocyte recognizes a plasma membrane glycoprotein called the major histocompatibility complex. Or MHC, as we usually abbreviate it. And again, you should be familiar with this from the reading that you did for today's lecture. In mice, where the experiments I'm about to talk about took place, in mice, several different genes for MHC exist. And depending on the cell type of the inheritance, how that mouse was bred, who its parents were, it may get different forms of the gene for MHC. And these have been used to study the process of metastasis. The experiments I'm about to describe to you actually, I think, were pretty well described in the course back article, so I will pretty quickly go over them with you and make sure you completely understand them. Remember in that article you read about two mouse cancer cell lines? Yeah, turn the page to the course back. Right. This is now on page 23. Remember you read about two cancer cell populations in mice? the G122 cells and the A9 cells. Remember that these two cancer cell lines differ in their ability to metastasize when you inject them into animals. D122 cells metastasize very, very frequently. A9 cells metastasize quite rarely. These cell lines also differ in the ability of their ability to elicit an immune response. If we just measure the ability of the recipient mouse's immune system, see whether its T lymphocytes are attacking, mounting response against those cancer cells, you find that the D122 cells, when injected, elicit only a weak immune response, while the A9 cells elicit a very strong immune response. This goes along with the fact that these two cancer cell lines, D122 and A9, have different MHC genes being expressed. So the D122 cells have only the H2D form of MHC in their plasma membranes, while the A9 cells have both the H2D form and the H2K form of the MHC molecule in their plasma membranes. Now, if you were to just look at these experiments, all you could really conclude is that a strong immune response is correlated with a low rate of metastasis. In other words, the A9 cells that metastasize rarely, that's correlated with a strong immune response. Vice versa, if you have a weak immune response, that's correlated with a high rate of metastasis. But the key word here is correlation. You cannot prove cause and effect here from this kind of observation. If I were to have jumped to the conclusion that the strong immune response elicited by the A9 cell is responsible for their low rate of metastasis, if I concluded that solely based on these data, I would be committing the post hoc fallacy, the kind of fallacy we were talking about in the discussion session last week. The fallacy of when you see two things that go together, A goes with B, therefore concluding that A causes B. Clearly, that's a logical fallacy. It might be something else that's causing this low rate of metastasis, other than the strong immune response. So this is just a correlation. How can we move from a correlation to a cause and effect, to proving that there really is a cause and effect relationship? This is an important issue, something hopefully you've been thinking about this past week, because I sort of challenged you at the end of last week's discussion to think about how could you design a better experiment to show the relationship between birth control pill usage and cancer? If there was, in fact, a relationship, how could you unequivocally show one way or another whether there was a cause and effect relationship? So you've hopefully been thinking about this. And one of the things that you might have been thinking about is doing some experiments. These are just passive observations. You've got to do some experiments if you want to prove cause and effect. One of the experiments you, again, should have read about in the course pack article, what was this experiment? The D122 cells, remember, metastasize very, very frequently, and that's correlated with a weak immune response. And we thought maybe the immune system has something to do with it. Well, if the immune system does have something to do with it, we could test that by changing the MHC gene being expressed in the D122 cell. So let's take these D122 cells and transfect them with H2K DNA. Transfection is a technique, if you haven't heard about it from your biology background, let me just quickly say it's a laboratory method for introducing DNA into cells. I'll talk more about it next week in more detail. But it's just a way, it was briefly described in the course pack article as well, just a way to get foreign DNA into cells. So we're getting this DNA coding for the H2K MHC gene into the D122 cells. As soon as we do that and inject those cells now back into mice, now they metastasize quite rarely. They're suddenly behaving like A9 cells in terms of their ability to metastasize. And they now elicit a strong immune response, just like the A9 cells. So this is much more direct evidence for the fact that the immune system does, in fact, influence. The ability to metastasize. We use the word influence, we're talking cause and effect. Well, we know now it's cause and effect because we've done an experiment. We've changed the immune response by changing the MHC gene that's being expressed on the surface of those cells, the MHC protein that's being expressed. Once we do that, the immune system now recognizes the D122 cells. It attacks them just like it attacked the A9 cells and drives down their rate of metastasis. So the immune response, the ability of the immune system to recognize and eventually destroy cancer cells, clearly can interfere with their ability to metastasize. These experiments clearly show that. But is the immune system the only factor involved? Or are there other variables that influence the ability to metastasize? Well, there's one more very clever experiment described in the course back article involving the use of immunosuppressed animals. If you want to find out whether or not the immune response, differences in the immune response, is the only variable influencing the rate of metastasis, the way to test that is to inject cancer cells by comparison into immunosuppressed animals. These are animals that have been treated with drugs that suppress their immune system, or there are strains of animals that have an inherently defective immune system. Either way, we're dealing with immunosuppressed animals which cannot mount an immune response. If the immune response were the only thing determining whether cancer cells can metastasize or not, then the difference between the D122 behavior and the A9 behavior in terms of metastasis ought to be completely obliterated in immunosuppressed animals, right? If the only reason that they're behaving differently in rates of metastasis is because they elicit different immune responses, then you get rid of the immune response, you should get rid of the difference. And those two cell lines should metastasize at the same rate. Notice that that's not what happens. The D122 cells still metastasize at their initially high rate, as you would expect. This tells you that the immune system is basically not capable under these conditions of attacking the D122 cells. The A9 cells in the immunosuppressed animals, remember, in normal animals, they gave you a low rate of metastasis. Now they go to a medium rate of metastasis. They metastasize more frequently, telling you that the immune system was, in fact, inhibiting their ability to metastasize. But they still don't metastasize as well as D122. So this suggests that there are additional factors. If the immune system, yes, is one factor, but there are other factors as well that can differentiate between different cell populations in terms of their ability to metastasize. Any questions on this study experiment? Clear? If you have any trouble at all when you go over your notes trying to follow what's going on here, then this set of experiments is pretty well described in the course pack article that I assigned to you. Okay, so we've now talked in detail about the first two steps in the process of metastasis. We've talked about the ability of cancer cells to invade through surrounding tissues and sort of penetrate into vessels. Now we've just talked about the transport of cancer cells via the bloodstream to distant sites of the body. And we've seen that most of the cancer cells die along the way. Most of them don't make it. And clearly the immune system is part of the explanation for why all the cells don't make it. The immune system can clearly attack cells along the way, but there must be some other factors involved as well. This now brings us to the third step in the process of metastasis. And that is the ability of cancer cells to reinvade and grow at various sites. And I'm going to say it's specific sites, and we'll see why I use this particular word in the next few minutes. What determines where cancer cells will actually end up reinvading into a tissue somewhere else, setting up housekeeping and forming an actual metastasis? Turns out that there are two different factors that play a role here. One of them is pure topography. It's based on the anatomy of the circulatory system. And if you'll turn to page 24, in the course, back, I've got a diagram here to help you understand what's going on. This is pure geography we're talking about. We're going to talk about three potential locations where primary tumors might arise. There are always three, I should say, three major categories of places where tumors can arise. Now, let's start off with the broadest category, which is category one down here, which is called body tissues and organs. And that literally means every tissue and organ in the body where cancer cells can arise, with the exception of the lungs and the stomach and intestines, because the lungs and stomach and intestines behave a little differently, as we'll see in a few moments. So let's talk about with the majority of the organs in the body. Let's say an individual had an osteosarcoma in the leg bones, for example. Where are those cells likely to metastasize? Well, as you saw in step one, they're going to, cancer cells, as they invade through the bone, are eventually going to encounter blood vessels somewhere. And the blood vessel they're most likely to invade into is going to be a very tiny capillary, because it's got the thinnest wall. So it invades into the capillaries, and the capillaries immediately, now the fluid flow, the blood flow, will be going towards the small veins, and the small veins feed into the larger veins, which feed into the larger veins, and finally end up in the right chamber, the heart. So we're going into bigger and bigger plumbing. Okay, we're starting out with cancer cells in a very, very narrow tube, going into bigger and bigger plumbing, where there's more and more room for them, until we end up in the right side of the heart. From the right side of the heart, these cancer cells, along with the blood, are going to be pumped into the lung. In the lungs, the pulmonary arteries break up into a series of veins, so the blood, a series of capillaries, so the blood can become oxygenated. So we go back down to very, very, very tiny vessels again, which is the way we started. When we started down here in capillaries, of course, the cancer cell is burrowing a hole into the vessel through its proteases and so forth. When it gets back here, back into capillaries, it's possible, certainly the cancer cell is going to be slowed down, and often the diameter of a cancer cell is such that it's going to have a very hard time fitting through a capillary. And if you happen to have a couple cancer cells sticking together, it will be almost impossible for them to pass through the capillary. So this is the first place where the cancer cells are going to have a hard time getting through the plumbing, because the plumbing has gotten so small, so narrow. So for most cancers that arise in the various body tissues and organs, other than the lung and the stomach and intestines, for most cancers, the first place they're likely to get hung up is in the lung. So the first place you would tend to look for metastases is in the lungs. And the lungs are, in fact, a major site of metastases for many kinds of cancers. What about for tumors that start in the stomach and the intestines, the so-called gastrointestinal tract? Here again, the cancer cells will infiltrate into very tiny capillaries, which will feed in the small veins, which go into larger veins, which go into larger veins. But these veins will then enter the liver. And in the liver, they will break up back into a capillary bed. The purpose of this being for the exchange of the nutrients that have been taken up and detoxification and so forth. All kinds of things have to happen in the liver. And the blood supply, therefore, breaks up into these little tiny capillaries in the liver. So you can have the various exchange of molecules that needs to take place there. But lo and behold, you have the same problem that you had before in the lungs. These cancer cells now are likely to be as big as or bigger than the diameter of these capillaries, and therefore likely to get hung up and stuck. So the most common site, or one of the most common sites for stomach cancer and colon cancer to metastasize to, is the liver, because that's the first capillary bed those cells encounter. Finally, what about lung cancer? In ways, lung cancer is the worst scenario of all. We've talked about the terrible prognosis for lung cancer. And here's one of the reasons that lung cancer has such a terrible prognosis. It kills so many people within 5 years. A cancer starting out the lungs will go into these capillaries. Blood flow will then push them into the vessels. They get bigger and bigger as they go into the left chamber of the heart. From the left chamber of the heart, the vessel gets even bigger, it's pumped out into the aorta, the huge vessel. Cancer cells have no problem. They're going to be pumped all over the body, through all the arteries of the body. They'll be distributed everywhere. And everywhere they go, they will eventually encounter a capillary bed. Okay? They could end up in here, they could end up in the stomach and the intestines, they could end up in the liver, they could end up in all the body tissues and organs. So lung cancer is a very, very nasty actor because its cells immediately are pumped out in the entire circulatory system and get access to capillary beds where they get stuck all over the body. So anatomy is the first factor, the basic anatomy of the circulatory system. The first factor that determines where cancer cells are going to metastasize. But those simple rules, those three rules I just gave to you, aren't the whole story. How do I know they're not the whole story? Let's look at another experiment. Experiment on page 25. If you take mouse melanoma cells, like the ones we've been talking about today, inject them into the tail vein of a mouse, what's likely to happen? Well, from the diagram on page 24, you know from the veins, you get eventually pumped into the right side of the heart. From the right side of the heart, you get cells are pumped into the lungs, or right side of the capillary bed. So we do expect these cells initially to get hung up in the lung. And in fact, if you look 1 or 2 days after you've injected those cancer cells in the lungs, you will find lots of cancer cells lodged in the lung. If you wait 2 or 3 weeks for actual metastases, not just individual cells, but metastases to grow up, solid tumor nodules that you can see as actual tumors, in fact, you get lots of these tumors in the lung, as you would expect from the rules that I just gave you. But you're going to see now, when we look at the right side of this experiment, that those rules weren't the whole explanation for what just happened. Let's do another experiment, the same exact cell type, but inject them into the left ventricle of the heart. As you see from the diagram on 24, if you inject cells or cells, cancer cells are in the left chamber of the heart, from there they are pumped out in the aorta, which means they are pumped out to the arteries all over the body. And so like lung cancer cells themselves, you would expect those to get lodged all over the body. And in fact, within the first day or two, if you look under the microscope at various tissues, you can find cancer cells lodged in various tissues throughout the body. But if you come back 2 or 3 weeks later to see, well, where are tumors actually growing? Where are metastases actually occurring? They're occurring almost predominantly, almost entirely in the lung. So this tells us it's not just the anatomy of the circulatory system. There's something else going on here. Not just the circulatory system. There seems to be something about these mouse melanoma cells. Don't overgeneralize. There seems to be something about these mouse melanoma cells that allows them to preferentially grow in the lung. Even though they lodged everywhere in the body, they only seem to grow well in the lung. So there's some kind of affinity, some kind of hospitality going on there. These melanoma cells like the lung. It's not just that the first place they stopped. It wasn't just the first motel they checked into. There was something nice about that place. So whether it was the first place or not, they end up occupying the lung. So this gives us a second principle that determines the sites at which cancer cells are going to grow in terms of metastases. The second principle, which we can conclude from that experiment, is that some cancer cells prefer to grow at specific sites. That's why I put the specific sites in this third stage. Some cancer cells prefer to grow at specific sites, certain sites. Some kind of, we think, biochemical affinity. There's just something about the molecules and the environment there in certain tissues that certain kinds of tumor cells like to grow in. Now, if that's true, it raises a very interesting question. Is this the same for all cancer cells? I've only shown you experiments thus far for melanoma. We haven't even looked at all melanoma cells. We've just looked at melanomas in this gross sense and found that as a total population, they seem to preferentially like the lung. But is that true for all melanoma cells? Do all melanoma cells prefer the lung? Or do some melanoma cells like other places? Well, there's been some very clever experiments carried out to address this question. If you turn to page 26, the first fact. Let's did an experiment here, which is a variation on the theme of the experiment described in page 21. I urge you to make a note in your notes not to confuse experiments on page 21 and 26. They look very similar to each other. They both involve these sequential selections and transplantations, but the conclusions that are drawn are significantly different because the experiment is done in a somewhat different way. So make sure you don't confuse the experiment on 21 with the experiment we're now about to go over. In this experiment, they took some mesmerized cells were taken and injected into the tail vein of the mice, just like experiment on page 21. On 21, we focused on the lung. We saw that metastases occurred initially a few in the lung, and we selected those and enriched for those. Here we're going to do something a little different. It's true the metastases occur mainly in the lung. Remember, when you start off, I said you only maybe got one or two of those. So you get many, many more metastases in the lung than you will in the brain and ovary. You may have to look at dozens and dozens of mice before you'll find one where there's a single metastasis in the brain or a single metastasis in the ovary. So these metastases to these organs are much less frequent than to the lung. Is this just a random fluke? Did they just happen to get stuck occasionally in the brain and ended up growing there? Or is there something special about those cells? Well, let's do now our sequential transplantation with cancer cells from these two different organs. Start out with the brain. We'll take that one brain metastasis that we found by scouring, you know, through 30 or 40 mice. Take that one brain metastasis, remove it, inject it into another mouse in the tail vein. Again, you'll find metastases predominantly in the lung, but every once in a while you'll find one in the brain or the ovary. This time you might find them a little more frequently in the brain than you had the first time. Let's take the metastases from the brain again, take those cancer cells, isolate them, inject them into another mouse, and repeat this over 10 times in a row. You repeat it 10 times in a row, and you will end up with a cell population that metastasizes mainly to the brain, metastasizes more frequently to the brain than to the lungs. You do the parallel set of experiments with the ovarian metastases, you get a comparable result. Eventually, you can select for cells that metastasize mainly to the ovary. They metastasize more frequently to the ovary than they do to the lung, and certainly way more frequently in the ovary than these would metastasize to the brain. So this tells you that cancer cells vary in the sites to which they preferentially metastasize. Again, all cancer cells are not the same. We saw earlier that all cancer cells were not the same in terms of their ability to metastasize, the frequency of which they metastasize. Now we see they're not all the same in terms of the sites to which they like to metastasize. So from a single cancer cell population, you can isolate subsets, subpopulations of cells that preferentially metastasize to different organs. Now remember, when we talked about the question of why some cells metastasize more frequently than others, I described to you some experiments which indicated the properties of the plasma membranes appear to be involved in determining the frequency or influencing the frequency with which cancer cells metastasize. Although the evidence isn't quite as good in this case, there's also some evidence suggesting that differences in the plasma membrane help to determine which organ a cancer cell likes to metastasize. So we've seen with the melanoma, we can isolate cancer cells metastasize the lung, those that like the liver, those that like the ovary, those that like the brain. And if you look at the plasma membranes of those three different subsets of cancer cells in that population, their plasma membranes look somewhat different, not under the microscope, but in terms of their biochemical makeup. So it appears to be interactions between the plasma membrane and components of these different target tissues, be it brain, ovary, or lung, that causes cancer cells of different types to preferentially metastasize to one organ or another. So the plasma membrane appears to influence not just the frequency with which cells metastasize, but also where they metastasize. Now, once cancer cells have picked the appropriate site, either from just being lodged there through the anatomy of the circulatory system, or through some more preferential mechanism, some kind of biochemical affinity which helps them to grow at a certain site. Once this has happened, there are again some other factors that come into play to determine whether or not extensive growth will take place. Extensive growth of metastases requires a couple things. The first thing it requires is angiogenesis, the process we talked about last time. Just like primary tumors, which must somehow trigger, switch the balance between angiogenesis stimulators and inhibitors, tip that balance towards stimulation to trigger the formation of blood supply in order to grow beyond a millimeter or two in diameter, the same thing is true of distant metastases. They must trip that balance in the favoring of angiogenesis at the distant site before they can grow beyond a millimeter or two in diameter. Remember, you have this complicating factor that if there's a large primary tumor somewhere else in the body, if that large primary tumor is producing large amounts of angiostatin, which can spill over into the bloodstream, unlike these other regulators of angiogenesis, that angiostatin can circulate throughout the body and show up at one of these sites where there's a little tiny tumor nodule, and that little tumor nodule with this massive amount of angiostatin in the circulation will not necessarily be able to overpower that inhibition. And so you may have these silent nodules of a milliliter or two for long periods of time until something triggers that balance towards net angiogenesis. So the molecules that regulate angiogenesis clearly play a role. Another family of molecules that appear to play a role are growth factors. I'm not saying that, unlike angiogenesis, which is always required, I'm not implying that growth factors are always required, but they may play a role. They may play a role. Now, just to make sure that you're clear on what a growth factor is, if you'll turn to page 27 of the course pack, I've briefly outlined for you here what a growth factor is. First of all, these are non-nutritional. You think of things making you grow, often you'll think of nutrients. These are not nutrients. These are protein molecules, but very specific kinds of protein molecules that stimulate the growth and division of particular cell types. They don't non-discriminately just stimulate the growth of any cell type, but there are different growth factors which selectively stimulate the growth of certain kinds of cells. For example, there's a growth factor called epidermal growth factor, or EGF, protein that stimulates the growth of epithelial cells. There's a growth factor called platelet-derived growth factor, PDGF, plays an important role in wound healing, stimulates predominantly the growth of fibroblasts. You've not heard of either of those before. I'm not going to hold you responsible for those two yet at this part of the course. Later in the semester, we'll come back and talk about these in some detail. So at that point, I'll hold you responsible for them. But notice that there are a couple, fibroblast growth factor, FGF, vascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF. These are ones you already know about. These are ones I will hold you responsible for knowing about in this part of the course, because those are ones that stimulate the growth of blood vessels, amongst other things. And therefore, these are the growth factors that regulate the process of angiogenesis. So the only two you read in this list that you really have to know about right now are these two that regulate angiogenesis. How do different growth factors manage to selectively turn on the growth and division of specific cell types? The answer is that different cell types have different kinds of receptor molecules on their plasma membrane surfaces. These are proteins expressed on the surface of cells. Depending on the receptor that you have on a cell, it will bind to different kinds of growth factors. So I've tried to illustrate this by having a complementary shape between a surface on this growth factor and this receptor on the surface of this cell. So this growth factor will only bind to cells that contain this particular kind of receptor, the receptor for that specific growth factor. And the binding of the growth factor to that receptor will send a signal through the cell. And by the way, later in the semester, we're going to talk an awful lot about all the steps involved in transmitting that signal, because the transmission of that signal is intimately associated with the loss of control of growth in cancer cells. So We're going to come back to this later in the semester and talk a lot about this pathway in detail. But for the moment, it'll just be sort of a black box. We won't talk about the individual steps. The growth factor binds to a specific receptor. It sends a signal into the cell that ultimately triggers the division of that cell. Now, if you read the Horsepack article closely, you will perhaps recall, maybe not, but you should be able to go back and find it. The D122 cell line behaves a little different regarding growth factors than the A9. Remember the D122. That was the one that metastasized more frequently than the A9. And remember, although the immune system played some role, that when we injected D122 and A9 cells into immunosuppressed animals to get rid of the immune response as a variable, even though we got rid of the immune response as a variable, D122 still metastasized somewhat better than A9. There wasn't as great a difference as before, but it still metastasized somewhat better. So there must be an additional difference between D122 and A9, other than the difference in the MHC, which influences the immune response. I can now tell you that this other difference is the fact that there's a gene called the FIMS gene, FMS, which has become activated in the D122 cells, but not in A9 cells. Now, what is the significance of this gene? This particular gene codes for a growth factor receptor. Remember, the receptor is the molecule on the surface of the cell to which a growth factor binds, therefore triggering that cell to grow and divide. So the D122 cells have a higher concentration of growth factor receptor on the cell surface. This means that for a given concentration of growth factor in the tissue, the A9 cell, which has fewer growth factor receptors, isn't going to be influenced as much, isn't going to have its growth stimulated as much as the D122 cells, because they have more, a higher concentration of growth factor receptor. Therefore, their growth will be stimulated more in the presence of the same concentration of growth factor. Any question on the set of options? Okay, then I want to remind you that there are three steps, as we've seen in the process of angiogenesis. Progressive metastasis. There's penetration of surrounding tissue, infiltration, invasion of surrounding tissues, and penetration of blood vessels was step one. Transport by the circulatory system to distant sites, influenced by the immune system and other factors was step two. Reinvasion and growth, finally, the distant site was step three. What I want to emphasize to you about the existence of these multiple steps, not only do we have multiple steps, but remember we have multiple variables influencing each one of those steps, impacting each one of those steps. So we have a very complex cascade of events taking place in the process of metastasis. And only a small number of cancer cells can successfully go through every one of those stages and exhibit all of those properties that you need in order to get through all of those steps of the process of metastasis. And that's why very, very few cancer cells actually successfully metastasize. A very, very tiny fraction of a cancer cell population successfully metastasize. I mean, if a person had, 100 metastases, that would be considered an enormous number. But you've got tumors that have millions and millions, if not billions, of cells in them. So only a very, very tiny fraction of cells successfully get through that complex series of events. The important point, important take-home lesson here, is if we could successfully interfere with just one of these steps, just one of these things I've talked about today, if you could stop the motility of the cancer cell in stage one, if you could inhibit the production of proteases or interfere with their action, if you could promote the interaction with the immune system, if you could influence any one of those steps to the detriment of the cancer cell, to the detriment of the cascade, then metastasis would not take place, and if metastasis didn't take place, cancer wouldn't be a disease that we'd have to worry about. Okay, that concludes what I wanted to say about metastases. As I promised you, I would occasionally let you go early this semester, and today is one such day. The next time, we'll talk about war properties.